by The Game Reviews and the Unified Gamers Network, you're listening to Big Red Potion Co-op Mode. I am joined today by Xanteria.
Hello.
And by The Digital Cowboys, by Alex Shaw.
Hello.
And Tony Atkins.
Hello.
Hey guys, how's it all going?
It's all going well.
We're both ill.
He said slightly hungover.
Slightly hungover and ill, yes. Well, I'm here.
So we've all got a game to talk about, and I guess I'll just get us started right from the off. I've been playing Final Fantasy XIII. Who else has played it here?
Me.
Me. Yeah, me.
Well, we've all played it then. How far did you guys get? Xan, did you finish it?
No, I have to say that I was a complete coward and I quit after about 25 hours.
After 25 hours. Yeah.
Well, that's how you're made to feel. There's so much peer pressure.
You didn't even get out the tutorials at 25 hours.
I didn't get beyond that. No, and there's so much peer pressure on Final Fantasy games and any kind of high profile JRPG. You know, if you start it, you're supposed to finish it. But I was in so much pain and under so much suffering that it just got to the point when my wife said to me, "You shouldn't be playing that anymore." So I stopped, and I'll probably go back to it in about a year's time. That's what I tend to do with things like this.
So we know where he stands then. He didn't enjoy the game.
Well, that's not strictly true. It's just it kind of just ground me down to the point where I just couldn't go on with it anymore. So it wasn't so much that... I know, it makes it sound like I didn't enjoy it, doesn't it?
It doesn't sound enjoyable. Oh, I love this grinding. Yeah.
That's right. I would say that in many ways there's a lot of good things about the game. But I think the thing that just finally was the nail in the coffin for me was the fact that I was just rinsing and repeating the same actions over and over and over again. And I was just sitting there thinking, well, there's lots of other things I'd rather be doing now and not doing this. And there's nothing really compelling me to carry on. So that's kind of where I left it.
Okay. How about you, Tony? How far did you get?
62 hours and completed.
Very good.
All the way to the very end.
Very good. How about you, Alex?
I got to the bit with where you're first exploring a giant flying ship. That's not much of a spoiler. It's a Final Fantasy game. And I didn't give up. I thought, I'll stop playing tonight. And then every time subsequently I went back to it, I was like, there's still Splinter Cell to do, or Bioshock 2, or God of War 2, because I've got to finish that before God of War 3. And there was just always something else to do. And eventually I just sent it back because I needed to get... I was renting it. And I will return to it, but it didn't grab me, really. I mean, I should have been like, oh, I'm loving this. The best thing about it, battle system.
Right. I'm trying to work out where the giant ship is. The giant ship's about, what, 10 hours in, I think, maybe? Is that right?
You actually got quite far. You got, like, chapter 6.
I'll do some checking in my giant, delicious, collector's edition player's guide up here, but I'll tell you in just a second. Hang on.
How about you, then, Zin?
Oh, I got to the end as well. It took me slightly less than you, about 58 hours.
I went on and done some more cycles.
Oh, you went on the... Yeah. I tried to do that and then I just... I went, no.
Well, that's why I stopped 58. At 62 rather than getting to 120, but yeah.
Yeah, cool. I think I just got the egg, which gives you double experience, and then weirdly decided that was a good point to stop. Which doesn't make any sense, but whatever.
Chapter 9, The Palamecia.
Oh, you got very far.
Yeah, 30 hours.
Well, that's good. I'll go back to it with gusto when it finally got some. I just need the time, you know. I haven't spoken to enough people who said it's worth the investment of time, because it's a lot of time, and I just don't really have much time.
Well, that's the thing. That is the thing. Like with all Final Fantasy games, you expect some period of acclimatizing and getting, you know, everything being revealed and the battle system, you know, eventually grinding into gear. I don't think I've ever played a Final Fantasy game where it's taken 25 hours. It wasn't totally dull for those first 25 hours for me. You know, Xan saying it's repetitive, but I didn't find it totally dull. I thought it was kind of in a purely superficial way kind of interesting, you know, just going from all these pretty worlds one to the other and all these exciting cutscenes and that, but the battle system was redundant for me up until you get to Pulse.
And that's the odd thing, because I completely agree with that. I mean, we reviewed Final Fantasy on our show, and my main point was, I think the battle system is really clever, really intelligent, and actually does move the genre forward a step. Most of the other stuff within the game is quite old, and even in many respects takes a back step in what the RPG or JRPG series has been doing. And that's why it's so strange to see this battle system. It's actually, you know, I really, really enjoyed it. Take 25 hours to kind of lay out there in front of you, because although it's complex, it's not 25 hours complex. It's, you know, 5 or 6 hours complex. It's, you know, a bit more into the game, tell us the story, but don't hold the best thing from the game until half the game has been completed.
I mean, is that what you were thinking, Zen, with it? Basically, was the battle system being totally repetitive?
No, not at all. No, I mean, I was going to jump in there and say that I completely agree with that. I mean, I thought the interesting thing with the battle system was what they kind of did was take what we had before, where we had, you know, the kind of rock, paper, scissors with the various elemental attacks. You know, it's the kind of typical JRPG trope, and then replace it with exactly the same thing. So they put in the auto battle to simplify that, so you don't have to worry about elemental attacks, and then they come up with paradigm shifts, which effectively are the same thing but not elements. So I thought that was a bit of a weird thing, but I actually thought the battle system worked really well. It wasn't that sort of ground me down. It was the fact that I think I got end of level 8, beginning of level 9 I got to, and it just, the thing with me, as you know, if you've heard me on other podcasts, you'll know that the big thing for me with any game like this is the story. It has to compel me, and the problem with this game is that I didn't find the story compelling at all. So although I enjoyed the battle system, what I got fed up with was the fact that I was constantly going from A to B, and every sort of 30 to 60 seconds there'll be another battle, and the only kind of variety I was getting was that sort of every half an hour or so, they would switch up the team, so I'd have two different people. And it just felt to me, I think this is probably, you know, I'm surmising it, but I think it's probably true, that it felt to me the game was deliberately stretched. So it felt, the mechanics were excellent, but it felt to me like the story and that, certainly that first 25 hours that I played, felt to me like it had been artificially stretched and elongated, made as long as possible, so that people felt they had a, you know, there's this kind of expectation that all Final Fantasy games should take 50 hours plus. So it felt to me they sort of took the beginning of the game and stretched it as far as they could get away with in order to make the game last longer. And that's what sort of, you know, ground me down, because the story was only kind of being revealed in sort of little 2-minute snippets that you earn every sort of 30 to 60 minutes. And I just thought, oh, I've had enough of this.
Yes, I think I agree with that. But it's kind of interesting, the sort of first half for me reminded me in a weird way, and I don't know whether this is going to draw gasps and sneers, of Uncharted 2. And I'll explain why.
Sneer.
Yeah, there you go. And they've all signed off. No, it's because, essentially, if you think of the combat as an exclusive thing in both those games, so you say there's the shooting in Uncharted 2, and there's the battles in Final Fantasy 13, and you take them away, you're essentially just got a third-person game where you're exploring, and you've got the people around you who are talking all the time about what's going on, and there's just lots of pretty stuff to see, and then you've kind of got it interspersed with cutscenes. But for some reason, in Uncharted 2, the storytelling seemed brilliant, and in Final Fantasy 13, it seemed terrible.
I'd put that down to one word. Charm. Nolan North is absolutely dripping with it, and there's not one character in Final Fantasy X that I was just like, you know what, I could not, I can't wait to see more of that character.
Also, the script is nowhere near as good. I mean, the script in Uncharted 2 was so polished and well written, whereas the script in Final Fantasy is stilted and dry, and it, you know, a lot of the characters sound like they were in different studios when it was recorded. You know, it's just not the same level of quality.
I found them all really bipolar, actually, all the characters. They seemed to be happy one moment and sad the next, and I couldn't really understand why what had actually provoked him to go into this, you know, great leap of enthusiasm or this giant pit of despair. It just seemed really artificial to me. That was my biggest problem. The other thing I found was that I knew nothing about the world of Final Fantasy XIII. Like, I didn't actually know anything about the society of Cocoon, about what do people like to do there. Like, you sort of think of Final Fantasy X and the first thing you see is that Blitzball game, and you immediately get this idea of that world. And then in Final Fantasy XIII, like, I think you barely see a town, and on top of that, I think there's the bits in the city, it looks futuristic, and beyond that there's nothing to suggest that there's any kind of actual society there.
But then what made you stick within 50 odd hours, 56 hours in that world? What was the driving force? I mean, because we're talking about story, it's not the best story. It's not the best Final Fantasy story. It's not anywhere near the best JRPG story. It's quite ridiculous at the point. The reason I'm being slightly hesitant on that, I think it actually does tie up rather nicely towards the end, and it explains a lot of that stuff. But you're talking like 45 hours before you start getting some nice conclusions to, you know, plot strands. But what kept you in there? If it wasn't the characters, wasn't the story, and, you know, the battle system didn't develop for a long time.
I think it's, you can see that sort of glimmer of potential in the battle system. I think you can see that it's going to be all about the paradigm shifts. About 10 hours in, you can see that's what it's going to be about. It's just you need the right monsters there, and then once you get to Pulse, they're finally there. And I don't know, it's almost, maybe I'm just, I've always been a huge Final Fantasy fan, and there's a bit of faith I was trying to get the game at that point. Yeah.
I think the emotional highs and lows can be brought down to the fact that the Final Fantasy games and a lot of other JRPGs actually are very neatly aimed at a teenage audience who are always a whirlwind of emotions, and they're always, you know, way up or way down. And there'll always be one control character who's very relaxed about things, in this case it's Saz, and who may have some darker things to deal with and some a lot more experience-based issues. But usually it's kind of par for the course that you're going to get, you know, people who are like, you know, they want something so badly, and they hate so much, or they love so much, and it's, they're just kind of up and down. I think maybe when I was younger, obviously this rung a bell with me a lot more, but as I've been getting older and been able to relate to the control characters like Saz a lot more, I kind of wish that they had a bit more sort of foreground, which is why I think Lost Odyssey appeals to Tony that much, because it's a bit more of a sort of mature look at it.
Start that debate. I
hope I'm not insulting all fans of JRPGs out there, but you know, you've got to admit it is kind of sort of teenage and angsty.
Yeah, I mean, what I ended up summarising in our show was, I think maybe the world's moved on. I'm not saying JRPGs can't exist. Quite frankly, I'll put over 60 hours into this one, so you know that's not true. But I think stuff like Mass Effect and Mass Effect 2 and Fallout 3. Although they're Western RPGs, they have spoiled us. We're used to, certainly in Mass Effect 2's case, you know, we're used to the story being, you know, fed to us pretty quickly, and being on this you know, great space adventure, this great romp, and all this stuff just being fed to us really quickly. In 20 hours, it's done, and it just feels like a compact experience. But this, it just feels like Zan said, it draws itself out over and over again. It's also a game of two halves. The first 30 hours is obviously teaching you everything you need to know about the battle system, and the next 20 hours up after that wraps up the story. But then after that, once you get to Pulse, I guess that's maybe a spoiler, but by this point, you know, I think, you know, anybody that really cares about Final Fantasy has probably played it. But, I mean, once you get there for the first time, you still aren't really leveled up enough to actually take on any of the creatures there, because they're really high level creatures. So you continue on with the story, you complete the game, and then I believe if you're really into Final Fantasy, that's where the game begins. It's about 50 hours in, because you get to take on these great creatures, your battle system is fully developed, all your characters are fully developed, you can switch in, switch out, and, you know, really make the game your own. And it seems to be an odd divide of who this game really is for. They've kind of opened it up for this new age JRPG group that I don't know whether it exists anymore. I don't know if that there's new people that are walking into this crowd. I would think at this point, probably not. And am I wrong? Have you ever seen new blood being brought into JRPGs?
Certainly not that defend it to the hilt like the old crowd do.
It's difficult, isn't it? I feel like maybe, you know, you have to look at how the PlayStation brought in those fans, then the PlayStation 2 brought in, I think, a whole new set of Final Fantasy fans in as well. Because you just have to look at the numbers, and they go up and up and up. So I don't know. And the sales figures for this game have been pretty high as well, actually. So
yeah, but also it's released on two platforms, which doesn't surprise me. I think, you know, Square Enix are clever enough to know that. I don't know whether JRPGs are dwindling, but the PlayStation certainly hasn't had a ton of them. They haven't done brilliantly on the Xbox over the, you know, the last couple of years since they've really been pushing them. And I think Final Fantasy was the one. My biggest problem was the one that was meant to be showing the light to all the others. That's what we kept saying, is Final Fantasy. This is where everyone's going to be copying the JRPGs. This is where they move forward. And in many respects, it moved back. It's odd.
Well, that's the question I wanted to end on, really, on this discussion. Do you kind of feel like Final Fantasy XIII is the proof that maybe the JRPG has actually finally fallen behind the Western RPG?
I think you can actually look to Japan to see where things are going, because there was a time that every sort of major JRPG that came out would be an overnight phenomenon. You know, it would still be people queuing around the block to get the latest copy. And I think the only thing that still happens with now is Dragon Quest. But the thing that really drives, the kind of golden child of Japanese gaming at the moment is Monster Hunter and Monster Hunter Tri. And though that is a westernized interpretation of action RPGs, certainly my experience of playing them is. And I think you can sort of see that's starting to change over there. You know, their tastes are also changing. I believe Mass Effect 2 did quite well, even though it was only released on a minor console.
That's right. Yeah.
I wouldn't say it's I think JRPGs need to realise what they are. I think it's a brave attempt trying to bring new players into the genre. I mean, that's how you keep genres alive, is to bring new blood in all the time. But I feel like with Final Fantasy XIII, they probably would have been better served talking to the people who already love the Final Fantasy games, that were going to go out and buy it day one and prove what you could really do in a hardcore JRPG. But I think, yes, the Western RPGs have had some effect, because we keep seeing the JRPGs trying to change a little bit, but I think it's the genre itself is too stale for it. I think, you know, the evolution of the JRPG genre has already worked, because it's called Western RPGs, and I'm not too sure there's too many people who love JRPGs actually want that. They get quite defensive, and I said that on the show, and we had quite a few people saying, look, I don't want to play Western RPGs, I want to play JRPGs. They can't turn into Western RPGs, because then, you know, they are two completely separate genres, so I don't think it's...
And they don't want everything to become homogenised and, like, all sort of a mush of different genres all blended together and saying, well, we took the best of every genre, why isn't it the best genre now?
Yeah, so embrace it.
Well, I think you go, Alex.
I think 12 was more progressive, because it was leaning more towards MMOs, so 13 is actually a step backwards. That doesn't mean that the JRPG genre can't progress, but as Tony said, they need to be very much aware of their audience and keeping them happy. Well, as far as I can tell, JRPG fans and Final Fantasy fans are loving 13. Very few people that I've heard of who are not all that enamoured of this are already huge JRPG fans.
Well, I'm not sure about that. I mean, talking to sort of my base of devoted Final Fantasy fans, it's very much 50-50.
Oh, right, okay, sorry.
And sort of just getting that kind of general internet vibe, I think maybe it's more split than that. But certainly there are a large contingency of devoted Final Fantasy fans who see nothing at all wrong with the game, which astounds me.
Do you think there's actually a pressure on Final Fantasy at this point? Because, I mean, it received 5s out of 10, 6 out of 10s, which, I mean, was historically very low for a Final Fantasy game. And, you know, if I was to give it a score, I'd probably give it a 7. It was, you know, an enjoyable romp most of the way through. It's just, you know, it doesn't feel like it moves the genre anywhere forward that I was expecting it to. But, you know, there seems to be such anticipation on Final Fantasy to be the best of the pack that you reckon that's kind of hampered them along the way, that they, you know, they just didn't know where to take it in a new direction.
I think there's certainly a pressure on Square Enix with the next couple of games, in particular Final Fantasy XIV. You know, you'd think if Final Fantasy XIII had been a huge success critically, then there'd be a lot less pressure on Final Fantasy XIV.
That's another MMO, though, isn't it?
Well, that's the thing, because Final Fantasy XI was such a decisive failure, really. There are people that still playing and enjoying the game, but I think it's not unfair to say it was not up to Final Fantasy standards. You know, I think there's a lot of a lot of pressure and scrutiny now on Square Enix. You know, the Versus game, what's that going to be like? What's 14 going to be like? And they've made a lot of strange decisions with who they've given control of these games to. You know, they gave Final Fantasy 13 to the guy who was behind 10-2 and 12 Revenant Wings, and these are games that were not exactly critically acclaimed. So I think that people will be watching what Square Enix does next, and certainly I think there's now even greater pressure on the next couple of games. But I mean, let's leave it on that, actually, because we've already spent about 20 minutes in the game. Well, I was going to just quickly say that to Alex's point earlier about, you know, sort of getting older and moving on past Final Fantasy games, did you guys see Lee Alexander's column at Game Set Watch, which was exactly on that subject, actually?
We did not, but I shall check it out.
I'll link to it in the show notes, but she said the exact same thing as Alex, that, you know, as she's grown older, she's kind of found it harder to resonate with the
Yeah,
the
that's exactly how we surmised on the back end of our shows. I'm not too sure.
We don't go in for the fist pumping.
Yeah, but I'm not too sure whether the game has changed so much. Whether me as a gamer, and you know all these other genres that are kind of been based around RPGs, have changed, and I've kind of grown up with them now, and kind of just left that one behind me. So. But saying that, I know for a fact that I felt that Final Fantasy X was a better game than 13. So,
and on that we're agreed. Shall we go on to next game? Alex, how about you? What have you been playing recently?
I'll be brief about this one because it's such a massively niche title. I've been playing Guru: Mark of the Wolves, which is the, I believe, 11th in the Fatal Fury series, which was released originally in 1999, and massively underappreciated at the time, because at the time, SNK were about to go under. And I think they also released it on the Dreamcast, and the cartridges on the Neo Geo, and indeed the Dreamcast game, have been, like, really rare and valuable and difficult to get. And I seem to remember on Giant Bomb, when they talked about this, Jeff mentioned that he had his like vacuum sealed copy of Guru: Mark of the Wolves that he'd paid like $100 for, that is now about to go down in price. It's available on XBLA, and the reason I got it is because, having played Super Street Fighter 4 the other week, I realised that after 2 decades of playing Street Fighter 2 and really loving it, I'm not very good at it. I played, 20 fights and got my ass handed to me 18 times. And I thought, I'm not that bad, though. Am I that bad at Street Fighter 4? And I looked at what I was doing in my fighting, and just the series of classics, like classic moves like jump in, high kick, duck, high kick, and just basically spamming dragon punch and fireballs, and also significantly jumping around between the new players, the new characters, and sort of experimenting with them, and getting my ass kicked by people who've only ever used Guile or only ever used Ken, mostly the latter. And I thought, I'm going to have to retrain myself at this point. And so I went back and got Guru: Mark of the Wolves, which is a very kind of specialized title. If you really, really like your technical Japanese 2D animated fighters, you'll already know what I'm talking about. You probably already have this.
Oh boy, do I.
If you don't, you're probably not going to like it all that much. It's very, on the XBLA version, it's very simple. It's very straightforward. It's not all about showy moves and filling up multiple bars. It's about the back and forth and learning to block at exactly the right time. And I thought, well, okay, so I'll just learn each character one by one and learn out their move sets of about 5 or 6 different special moves and learn to block and counter. And thus, I have been training myself to fight, because I am so sick of losing to button bashers and losing to people who are actually quite good at the game, and just basically being not at all good at Street Fighter. So this is what I'm doing. I'm training myself up.
So is it any
good?
Has
it worked?
Yeah.
Guru: Mark of the Wolves is one of the best 2D fighters I've ever played. It's very similar to Street Fighter 3. In fact, I think Street Fighter 3 was the one where they really looked at what SNK had been doing for the past 10 years and thought, well, we could probably incorporate that. It's very quick, it's very smooth, it's got, you know, Street Fighter Alpha style animation with like the sort of little extra moves like the hair toss and stuff, and that sort of really nice chunky hand-drawn sprites, and there's something really charming about hand-drawn sprites now that they don't do them that much in fighting games. It's if you're a fan of Blaze Blue, I suppose it'll feel like a step down, but it's that kind of game, you know, the sort of, you know, big I mean, it's all effectively just Street Fighter, but refined in the way that SNK have been doing for 10 years or so. And I've never really gotten into the technical fighters because I've always liked button mashers like Tekken, but that's kind of what made me think, well, that's probably why I'm not that good. I've also invested in two, count them, Hori EX2 arcade sticks, so I can replicate the kind of arcade
it's
environment.
It's a phenomenon that's going around. I said everyone buying sticks.
I bought my first Hori EX2 stick last week, just because in game they had it for £25, and it was it was okay. Well, I'm trading in a game to get Street Fighter 4 free. So
£25 brand new.
Yeah.
Shit! I just paid 30 for one of them. The other one I got for £25. Okay.
Sorry, Alex.
Thanks. You didn't mention that to me when I didn't ask you. Sorry. But yeah, no, that's good because it means that I can. See, I had a Hori last year when Street Fighter 4 came out, and you know, it wasn't instinctual to me. I'd never really been that big on arcade sticks, so it took a while for me to get used to it. But significantly, whenever I played up against someone who was just using the pad, they'd whinge and whine, well, you've got a stick, that's not fair. So, and if they beat me, they'd be like, well, I beat you, and you were even using a stick. And so I thought, right, okay, even Stevens, we'll both have sticks. That way, if I beat you,
I only ever did
skill.
It once.
But it also, I've realised I've got like 22 arcade games on my Xbox alone, which would really benefit from being able to use an arcade stick. So I'm also thinking of getting a full arcade cabinet or something. So this would be kind of a good practice run for that, and see if that really appeals to me in the long run. It's a lot cheaper as well.
That was a question I was going to ask. So you did play Street Fighter 4 last year, and you struggled with that, or did you sort of?
I didn't struggle with it. I'm just not that good at it. Ultimately, right. Once again, I kept going online, and it's like, well, who am I fighting now? I guess I'm fighting Ken. Yeah. And they'd just jump in and go, well, I guess you're going to Dragon Punch right now. Oh, you did, and I blocked it, and yet still it got through. What am I doing wrong? So, yeah, it's down to being able to block faster and more effectively and counter.
Right. Because I played Street Fighter 4 religiously last year, and then I took a break, I guess, at the beginning of this year, just because I knew Super Street Fighter 4 was coming around the corner, and I just needed... You can't play the same game for the whole year. So I came back to it, and I thought I've just forgotten everything. Everyone's beating me relentlessly, and I've just lost
Would
everything.
Would you like a game, Sinan?
We should have a game. I'll feel
beating
much better.
Beating you relentlessly, you said. That'll make me feel better.
But I think that's the thing, you know, with Super Street Fighter 4, everyone has been playing Street Fighter 4 for a year and is really rather good now. So I feel like the quality is much higher than it was when I started Street Fighter 4 last year.
Maybe that's it then. Maybe the reason that I was getting my ass kicked was by people who had literally just been playing and playing and playing and playing and playing, and then they just jumped over to Street Fighter 4 and thought, wow, look at all these new characters. Ken.
But I would argue, though, that there must be a whole wealth of new players coming in because, I mean, that game's kicking around for £20 most places. That's a bargain if you haven't picked it up before. You know, and you just think, oh, maybe I will at this point. £20 for that content is ridiculous.
And if you don't buy Super Street Fighter 2, and you, sorry, 4, and you haven't bought Street Fighter 4 on its own before, you could probably pick up Street Fighter 4 on its own for like a fiver now.
Well, I mean, that's a good question. I mean, is it worth it? I mean, at this point, then surely Super Street Fighter 4 is the way to go.
I think Street Fighter 4 is essentially redundant now, isn't it?
Yeah, Street Fighter 4 on its own is kind of like when Turbo came out on the SNES, no one wanted the original Street Fighter 2 anymore. And yet, originally it was going on grey import for £100.
Well, as somebody that really doesn't like fighting games, we'll play him when he's round other people's houses, but you know, it's not a genre that I actually pick up on my own and play within my own time.
That's why I want to get good at it, Tony. It's the only one I can beat you on.
But, so, I mean, is it accessible to jump in something like Super Street Fighter 4?
No.
I mean, I would say the reason...
Absolutely not.
But the reason
certainly
I
not
ask,
for online matches, no.
The reason I asked, though, is obviously the online stuff. I've heard a lot of people say this is so much better just because of the online lobbies and the way that they can jump in there and everybody can be watching and then giving out tips and saying, look, you need to do this, you're not doing this.
That is much improved.
Is that the most accessible this game can get for somebody that's not with the genre?
It helps. I mean, I've got to give... huge credit to Paul Rooney, Sally Hitoshura, who's basically been training me on how to play Street Fighter.
Was there a montage?
yeah, well, basically...
After you with the training there, Zan.
because you can have 8-player lobbies, and obviously you get to see all the other fights. And Sinan was in a few matches we had. What he was doing, because he's so much better than everyone else, what he basically does is spend most of his time trying to coach us. And he basically tries to demonstrate some of the moves and stuff. But the problem I find is that even when people are trying to explain to me what they're doing, it makes absolutely no sense to me whatsoever. I'm kind of in a similar position to both of you guys, really, in that I quite like fighting games, and in fact, Soul Calibur I absolutely love. I adore that.
Yeah, that's
game.
A button masher's dream. That game.
Yeah, it is.
It's completely different in many ways. Because I was explaining to someone at work the other day. She was asking me about it. In that Street Fighter, it feels to me gesture based, whereas things like Tekken and Soul Calibur are very much sort of combo based. It's remembering combinations of buttons and when to react. Whereas with Street Fighter, it's there's much more about your positioning and what you do and how you follow things up. It's far more. I wouldn't say tactical, but you need to know so much more. And these things like the EX gauge and all this, it's beyond me. And when you get the manual, it makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. And even when someone's trying to explain it to you and you're seeing people doing it, it's very difficult to equate what someone is doing and what you actually see on the screen. So unless you see someone's hands when they're playing it, it's still really difficult to actually pick up. And the problem I found with both, because I've got Street Fighter 4 on the PS3 and I bought Super Street Fighter on the Xbox, and I've actually got sticks for both, so I've got like a whole bloody cupboard full of sticks now. I've got Virtual Fighter as well, which is where I've got my Hori stick, but I've been using the pads, which are the, I don't know if you've seen them, they're the Mad Cat's official pads.
They look nice.
The six-button ones.
Yeah, well, I find them a lot easier. The problem is that you get blisters on your thumb, because your thumb gets so hot doing all the swirls and swishes and, you know, half turns and stuff, that your thumb actually sort of bakes itself to the plastic. But there's no kind of tutorial in either of them, and you can do like the training mode where it tries to teach you what the moves are.
But you'll get to a point where it's like, hang on, I can't do this combo. Well, you do it, try it over and over again.
There's two parts to it. Firstly, you get to some of the combos, you think, well, I just can't do that. That's beyond any human being's ability to be able to do that. And then secondly, you then play someone who knows what they're doing and explains to you that actually half the time you don't want to be doing those things. And, you know, a lot of the stuff about it is actually sort of cancelling out of moves and, you know, sort of frame counting and coming out of an animation halfway through. And you think, what? What's that? What does that mean?
So then is that, back to Alex's point, then, is this something that should have been ingrained to me as, you know, and from childhood of playing Street Fighter? I mean, that's not something I played when I was a child. So, you know, well, the idea of jumping into it now,
we have got kids
daunting.
Picking it up for the first time ever and going, right, and actually being quite good at it, so...
Yeah, but they're kids
of
today.
It's not out of the question. Yes, these kids with their...
This old man's brain can't cope with that fast.
Put it like this, if you've already got kind of a knee-jerk reaction to them, it's going to take a lot of personal will to get over that hump to actually enjoy it. Actually, you're not bad at them. You have beaten me in the past repeatedly, Tony, so it's...
Yeah, but that just makes it more funny.
Yeah. Isn't it? You hate them, and yet you still beat me sometimes, quite a lot of the time.
Right? Well, often if you play someone who maybe only knows one or two moves or doesn't know what they're doing, I think that's the frustrating. A lot of people play online and they come up against these millions of Kens, because there's a lot of people who know like two or three moves. And the problem is that if you're trying to approach it from the point of view of trying to learn what you're doing and try to try out some clever techniques and stuff,
and they just keep
your
jumping
ass,
and
you just get your ass kicked, yeah, because they'll just keep you spamming the same three moves.
Dragon punch.
So, do you not think we're just kind of missing the point here? I mean, Super Street Fighter 4, from all purposes, from what I can see, is meant for the guys that love Street Fighter 4 and now want that proper online experience, which, you know, Street Fighter 4 didn't have.
Well, I was going to say that, I mean, the thing with Super Street Fighter 4 is it's actually a lot less accessible than Street Fighter 4, I think, because of the training mode. Street Fighter 4 had an option where you could see the move played out to you.
Yeah.
So you could see the AI play out the move for you and then have a go yourself. And I found that intensely much more rewarding and helpful than anything I found in Super Street Fighter 4, any of the replays or any of that, just to see what I'm meant to be doing was actually far more helpful than, you know, a manual or anything like that. So I feel like, Super Street Fighter 4 is definitely and quite blatantly aimed at people who had Street Fighter 4 and want to move on. So I guess, I don't know, if you're looking at it as, I want to pick up a Street Fighter game, but I don't really want to give it too much of my time, I wouldn't actually go with Super Street Fighter 4 in a way. If you're not really going to play it online, then
go for Guru Mark of the Wolves.
Oh, Yeah.
I'd imagine the only reason I would be picking up, though, would to be, you know, playing with people from, you know, our community and whatnot. But
yeah.
Frankly, you know, there's a million and one other games that I could probably put my time towards. But it, I mean, I love the fact that there is so much hype behind fighting games again. It happened last year with Street Fighter 4. And everyone going out and buying sticks. And the reason I actually picked up Street Fighter 4 last year is because I was like, wow, this hype, it's amazing, I'm going to buy this as well. And then realised it's just, you know, it's not a genre I don't glue with very well. So it's lovely to see that and everyone getting so excited about this stuff, because it's been a long time since, you know, fighters pulled any kind of weight in the industry.
I just want to get to the point where if I meet someone who's obviously just jumping all over the screen and smashing the pad, that I could just do a neat and block counter for every single one of their, you know, improvised moves, and just go no, down, no, down, so I could defend against the button mashers and just put them in their place. That would be, that's just my ideal standard as far as I'm concerned. I don't need to be a super duper player, just someone who can go up against people who don't know what they're doing and actually just, you know, wipe the floor with them. That'd be good.
You have to keep us updated then on how your training goes.
Oh, I will. I need a montage.
We'll get that music in for now. The Rocky music. Shall we move on to the other Digital Cowboy? Tony, what have you been playing?
I mean, the usual balance of stuff. Some Splinter Cell, but a lot of FIFA World Cup. But I won't bore your audience with FIFA talk. but it's good. You should buy it. Mostly Halo Reach Beta. Or Beta. We stand on this. Beta. Beta.
Beta.
Beta.
Beta.
Beta. Beta. Beta. That's the British way, it's beta, isn't it?
Yeah. We're British. Beta.
Beta.
Beta Max.
Oh, good God, don't add a third. And, I mean, yes, it's, I mean, and there's no point boring the audience with what the hell Halo is, it's been a long time coming, Reach. Halo 3 to me was always something that was kind of pushed out a door again by it from Microsoft. I mean, I played literally thousands of games of Halo 3, but I mean, it had its flaws. So I've been really looking forward to just the Reach Beta, and what a kind of beta is. And can you imagine any other company sticking a beta out there other than maybe Blizzard? And the day one stats reading 1.2 million games played. Oh no, 14 million games,
yes,
played.
Call of Duty.
To be fair, I mean, actually, Call of Duty has a big effect on the Halo Reach. I mean, have any of you guys played it? Other than me just continue talking.
Yes. Yep.
No, I'm the only one who hasn't. I was just scared by the collective. I think the stat was 30 years of collective gaming life lost on the first day of Halo Reach, which is, well done, everyone.
It's a popular franchise.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I can talk ad nauseam about it. So, what does anyone else not like it? Are the reasons?
I pretty much don't like it, I suppose.
Reasons.
Where do I start? I think to start with, it's worth, you know, I've played these, I've known the Halo franchise since the very first game. You know, I bought an original Xbox on day one, and I have much love and affinity for Combat Evolved, but each Halo game that's come out after that, I've liked less and less and less. And
you liked Halo 3 less than Halo 2.
I did, yeah. And largely because, as I mentioned earlier, there's two reasons for that, really. One, that, you know, I put really, you know, the enjoyment I get out of games really does stem from one of two things. One, that I find it a very sort of visceral experience, or two, that there's a story that really drags me in and really makes me want to find out what's going on, or get to the end, or what happens with the characters. And I think on both those counts, Halo has got weaker and weaker and weaker the longer it's gone on. I mean, in particular, the storytelling was nonsensical in Halo 3.
The problem with that was that you need some knowledge of the universe around it. I mean, essentially, you need to read the books. It's quite funny how much they patch in around that.
Well, that's pathetic.
Yeah, I agree, yeah.
I mean, I played through the Halo 3, I played through it entirely at least 10 times, because I played through it a lot in co-op, and the co-op was the best thing about Halo 3. But I have absolutely no idea what happens in that game. And I'm not, you know, obviously I'm not stupid, but it just doesn't make any sense whatsoever. And so to compel me to go back and play it again really requires me to have three friends and to just go through and do it for you know, shits and giggles, basically. And with the multiplayer, again, I mean, if you look on my Game of Voice, whatever it's called, I think you'll see that Halo 3, I think it's like the third highest most game I've played. It's like something stupid like 50 days or something. So I have played the multiplayer a lot, but I can honestly say that I didn't enjoy it, you know, all the time. And the issues I've always had with the Halo multiplayer is that, for me anyway, it always feels... I feel like I'm not actually in control, and I feel like everything's very floaty and light and unresponsive. That's just the way that Halo multiplayer has always felt to me, always going back to Halo 2. And I played the beach beta, and of course you've now got all these kind of loadouts, haven't you? And you've got the jetpacks. And for me, anyway, it's basically made exaggerated all the things I didn't like, and has diminished all the things that I did like. So now there's loads of idiots who are flying around in the air, leaping about with jetpacks on, and I don't know, it just felt to me like it was going in a direction which no longer appeals to me, and it's not something that I don't think I'd get a lot of enjoyment from.
You're not entirely wrong, and Call of Duty has had clearly, or Infinity Ward have had a clear influence on the way that Halo Reach is going in its multiplayer. I mean, single player, well, who knows, we'll talk about it at the end of the year. But, I mean, multiplayer wise, yeah, one of the big things that you've just mentioned is loadouts, so the abilities. You can pretty much start most games, well, actually, there's different games types you can use different things, but yeah, you have abilities now such as active camo, so you can have that as a mainstay, or armor lock, where basically you go into this big shielded dome where no one can touch you for, I think it's about 5 seconds. The jetpack and sprints. So, and certainly with the sprint, it feels like, you know, okay, this is something. Actually, when I was playing a lot of Call of Duty and came back to playing Halo 3, I was like, well, where's the sprint button? It felt quite outdated in many respects. But so that they've kind of addressed that, the crowd that love Call of Duty with the perks. And I'm not too sure they actually work. A lot of us, we've been playing it, we've every time a new map comes up, we try to, like, classic Slayer. So it basically takes away all those perks and just gives you the run button. But saying that, a lot of it's still got to do with the group of people you play with. We had a big Digital Cowboys game night recently, but before that, I think I've racked in about 60 or 70 games. And if you have a good group of players that know what they're doing and know how to use each perk to their fullest advantage, it becomes really fun again if you know the points to kind of hold. And I've always said this, I still think Halo is a more tactical game than Call of Duty. Call of Duty is just spawn and die. And whenever you're working as a team, it's always to do with how well you can do yourself to get more honor points or prestige points. And Halo's never really been about that. It's always been about, look, if you work as a unit, then you will survive. If you know, if one person goes off running in front, you will die. And this continues that. But I think actually the way that they're pushing it forward, they've done some really interesting game modes. They just recently released this invasion mode, which is basically, for all intents and purposes, Battlefield. You have to capture points, and once one point is captured, it moves to the next point, and then once the final third point is unlocked, you have to get this generator and bring that out and bring that to the, you know, a central point and win the game. And it just feels like Halo is willing at this point to kind of experiment. It's, you know, the long-running series, it's the fourth big game for Bungie, and as we know, it's their kind of swan song. So I have faith that there's lots they're actually going to do with it, and I've had some really good games.
I guess it depends which way you look at it, because I kind of look at that, because, you know, I'm not a fan of Call of Duty either, actually. But my kind of benchmark, for me personally at the moment, for a kind of first-person shoot would be, you know, Bad Company 2. Because that's just the kind of... Which is my old team and objective base.
Yeah, I agree.
And I totally agree. I've mentioned a few times, for me, things like Bad Company 2 and Battlefield 1943, they are four-player co-op games.
Yep.
It just happens you're playing against humans, but it doesn't really matter. What you're really doing is you've got three mates, and you're just having a good laugh, working together and doing things. And certainly, on the other Halo games, I think particularly Halo 3 and ODST, in co-op, I thought they were excellent. You know, and I thought that was the best thing about them, disregarding the fact that you didn't understand the thing that was going on. You know, actually playing those with three mates was really good fun, and the firefight was really good as well. Played quite a bit of that the other week, actually, but it just feels to me that You know, you say they've included these new modes, but what else could they have done? It's like, to me, they've reached the point where there's not a lot else they can do with this Halo multiplayer other than borrow ideas from other areas.
But isn't that catch 22 though? Because I mean, a lot of people complaining, well, it's just Halo. Well, yeah, because if they turned it into anything else, everyone would be shouting, well, they've ruined Halo. And I think there's a lot of people shouting about, you know, this new perk system has ruined Halo in itself. I think what you're actually seeing over a period of time, and you're already seeing, if someone's in a jetpack and they're in the wrong map or in the wrong game mode, they will be killed pretty fast because they have no, you know, retort. They just fly up in the air and you take them down. They're actually a rather easy kill. Yet if you're playing something like Oddball, and there's a guy at the top of the map, and it's imperative that you actually get up there and not follow all the stair routes, then wham, bang, you quickly die, you use that perk, and you go up to the top, you quickly get the ball, and then, you know, the next situation, you're right, he's down the bottom, lets you sprint. And, you know, for stuff like that, I think it's a new kind of angle that Halo hasn't actually taken before.
Okay. I mean, I guess we could probably get onto this when we talk about the fourth game we were going to mention, but I think there is a problem with let's say a brand, because in effect Halo is becoming a brand, because presumably Bungie will give up Halo to Microsoft. In that, when you get a new game come out in the series that has the brand name on it, there are certain expectations. So there's going to be the people who loved the previous game will want it to stay the same, or they'll want it to have improvements that back up the reason they like the first game. And then there'll be a whole load of other people who will be like, well, why am I buying and playing the same game again? It's almost like, if you look, I mean, you mentioned FIFA. I mean, FIFA routinely is a, you know, kind of incremental update to what was there before. But every so often, there's a complete change. And there was a complete change in FIFA a couple of years ago, wasn't there, where they completely redid the engine. I mean, if you compare FIFA 10 to FIFA 7, they're different games almost. Okay, they're both football, but they're completely different games. And for me, it just feels like we've reached the point where I think that the Halo multiplayer needs to be more than just what we've had previously and chucking in a few ideas from other genres. I would have personally liked them to have maybe experimented more with what they achieved with the co-op and what the direction they were going in with Firefight, and maybe looking to expand that in different ways. Maybe they'll still do that. I mean,
yeah,
we don't know, do we?
They have said, I mean, this is a very limited look at, you know, a few game modes. I mean, there's three maps. I'm, to be honest, fairly sick of playing those now, you know, number of games in, and they promised, you know, there is a lot more to multiplayer, and obviously single player will have, I think it's four player co-op, as you know, as we suspect. But I mean, they have done some neat stuff. There's actually a game mode which I know Alex particularly likes. It's called Headhunter, and that's basically where once you kill somebody, they drop a skull. You pick up the skull, and then the idea is to pick up a skull, take it to a point, and bank that skull. But you can pick up anything up to 10 skulls in a row.
Goal tick.
As you hear over and over again. But once you've got those, then you need to get to the point. Now, you can be killed anywhere along the line. It actually puts an arrow above your head how many skulls you've picked up along the way. So you can start seeing that someone across the map has got 5 skulls, and the target is 25. So you go hunting for them. And suddenly everyone can go hunting for them. And there could be 20 or 30 skulls lying around the ground that nobody can get out of these areas to bank these skulls. Is that it's a really, really funny game mode, because just as you think, right, I've got to the point, I'm going to bank these and win the game, you'll get sniped from a distance and your head will pop off, and off they go again, and everyone's trying to pick those up and desperately trying to get them in. And
it's kind of
so
what
funny.
I think they were trying to do with the treasure mode in Uncharted 2's multiplayer, although obviously not team based. This whole idea of scrambling around with these things, and it's what Oddball should have been to begin with. Oddball is just a case of ball dropped, ball taken, ball dropped. It's because there's only one ball, it makes it just so much more kind of focused on this, moving this ball 1 millimeter to the left, and just it changing hands every 5 seconds. Not even 5 seconds. Mm-hmm. But with this, because there's so many skulls sort of knocking about the place, and every time someone dies, a new skull is born, effectively, it makes like the last few minutes of it just become insane, with skulls scattering everywhere.
But, I mean, to talk about your point, Zan, I mean, it's so hard. I mean, what do Bungie do, or what do Microsoft do at this point? You know, you either play Halo or you don't, and is it worth going for the new crowd? Do you upset the current crowd? And I'm not too... I think this is a fairly even balance from Bungie, saying, look, you know, we're going to change some stuff, but at the same time, yeah, it's still Halo. And actually, for me, it's actually... more upsetting that something like Battlefield Bad Company 2 hasn't done, I mean, it's done pretty well, but it hasn't done the same amount of numbers as something like Halo and Call of Duty, because that's a truly remarkable game that should be in pretty much everybody's first-person shooter possession. And it's done kind of lukewarm, even though the reception has been absolutely fantastic. But I think it's going to take a new IP, or you know, it's certainly a new IP, to come along at some point and kind of break the mold again, because you know, Halo is a long old series, and Call of Duty, I mean, what are they going to do for the next Call of Duty? More perks? Yay! You know, that's just, that doesn't appeal to me.
Well, that's the question I have, as probably the, you know, the version of Tony in this, who is listening, going jetpacks, perks, you know, I've played a bit of Modern Warfare, Modern Warfare 2 online. I've played Halo Combat Evolved, but I didn't play Halo 2. I haven't played Halo 3 ODST. I'm completely behind on the Halo franchise. Like, it just, it sounds to me almost like what Zan's saying with the whole FIFA pre-evolution thing, that you've got these two franchises who are continually borrowing off one another. And I just wonder, someone who say hypothetically may pick up Reach when it comes out, am I going to notice any real difference from it and say the next Call of Duty, Black Ops? I mean, apart from the setting and things like that, well, is it just going to be very similar multiplayer?
Well, the games are very, I mean, they play completely different, as you know. I think you'd have to compare it more to something like Battlefield, to be honest, although you know the settings are very, very different. But I mean, my last point is, I think for me, Halo has always been fun. I mean, our recent game night was proof of that. Out of the 3 hours that we played, I don't think anyone stopped laughing. There was so much joy and so much like, oh, and Call of Duty to me is certainly more about, you know, it's whether I can improve myself. It's almost being like a professional game player. You always want to be better. You always want to get a higher number. And for me, Halo's always been about, you know, producing something for the team and making sure that maybe you're the leader and can tell them that, you know, we need to defend this corridor, don't just go wandering out there. So I don't know. I don't know where this ends. And in fact, it's only a 3 week beta, which is pretty short. So, you know, I guess we'll find out at the end of the year what they're going to bring. But overall, I think I'm happy where the series is going. I don't know. I think Bungie have jumped off at the right point, because I'm not too sure where Halo can go now beyond, you know, obviously it's done, you know, the mainstay of the franchise. If you read the books, Reach is a good a place as any to kind of start off again. But I think Bungie are happy to start for a new franchise, and that's a little bit sour as well, because you wonder what support Reach will get in the future, being as, you know, Bungie are off gallivanting around with Activision producing different games, and whether it's going to have the legendary support that Bungie's always given its player base. And I guess we'll wait and see.
ODST did kind of feel like they were just sort of,
yeah,
it kind of felt like Guitar Hero rocks the 80s, this kind of swan song to, oh, we're not doing Halo anymore, here you go, have that, but you know, enjoy, see you later. But I mean, I did love Firefight, that was good.
Yeah.
Okay, I think maybe, yep. Have we done Reach?
Yep, we've done Reach.
I don't know, I feel like I was just listening.
Well, yes, I like Reach.
I think it's always awkward trying to come up with a full opinion just playing a beta. I'm not really a great fan of betas, personally. I know why they do it, and I know they obviously get something out of it as well, don't they, because they can balance the game. But
well, it can have a negative effect on games.
I don't like the current trend for betas, and the Blur beta I thought was a bit of an insult, because I mean that's a demo, it's not a beta.
Yeah, I agree with that.
I mean, saying Reach was clearly somewhat of a beta, because the first night of it being launched, there may have been 1.2 million people trying to play it, but only about, you know, two people managed to play it, because it pretty much collapsed. so we'll see in the future. But anyway,
I think you're right. Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, at this point, you know, you've got two different views here. For, you know, for myself, it has expanded on the bits that I don't like. You know, so the leaping around business. But I do quite like, quite like you said, I mean, I've played some of the game modes, and I did like the skulls thing, I must admit. But it seemed very chaotic. Do you know, it reminded me of Fat Princess, funny enough. Because it was a really good idea, but it never seemed to actually have an end, if that makes sense. And Fat Princess is the same. I don't know if you've played any of those, plenty of that at length, but you nearly always end up with a stalemate where no one actually can kind of push it over the line.
That might just have been because teamwork was essential for Fat Princess, and it just wasn't implemented enough, so that people just weren't working together. They were just all you know, there was just chaos, and that should have been a lot more straightforward in terms of what was supposed to be happening.
Well, I will say, though, I mean, beta-wise, I think Bungie are pretty open as a company, and I think they will be looking at what, you know, there's been a lot of complaints, certainly about armor lock seems to be riling up a lot of people, saying how useless it is and powered it is, and I think I was looking at stats, like over a billion seconds have been played, and like you say, multiples of millions of games, and all that stuff they've taken stats from, they can see what's, you know, what maybe works and what maybe doesn't, and not too many betas normally have that kind of ability, have that multiple millions of people kind of you know, giving their opinions. So I think hopefully it'll be for the better, or for the best, rather than a negative effect. So, but yeah, the Blur beta, it was fun, but it was a demo, and it eventually ended up as a demo, proving how much of a beta it really was.
I think you just have to look at the Little Big Planet beta for a lot of people making up very quick early opinions on a game without really getting a chance to play it in full. I think, you know, maybe it's different for a first-person shooter, especially in an established series where a lot of people, like, you know, yourself and Dan and Alex, know what they're going to get, pretty much, and know what they're looking for.
Yeah, and in many respects, it goes back to our Street Fighter conversation here. You know, for somebody that hasn't, you know, integrated into the series up until this point, you know, for me, I look at that and it's so daunting. It's like I probably shouldn't start at the top. I should work my way from the bottom. And it's the same as Halo now. And you have Halo players, you have Call of Duty players, and there's not too many people that play both at the same time, because, you know, you're kind of like, well, I prefer the way this controls. But as somebody walking into that, I don't know how you would manage to pick up Halo and then go on to, you know, online multiplayer matchmaking and just not feel sorry for yourself, because, yeah, it's a pretty harsh learning environment.
I might tell you later on this year when I eventually get around to doing that myself. Yeah, if I ever... You've kind of put me off. Yeah, you've put me off a bit now.
Big Bad Illusion. The Info Games Network. True Games Screencast. Ninja Fabian. Web.uk. TheGameScene.com. Some of the finest podcasts.
There's a little something for everyone.
Some of the finest podcasts from around the UK.
Serious analysis of Big Red Potion to the firm but well-informed Gamerdork UK. Gamerdork, 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 Gamerdork. Find like-minded comment. Keep your hobby alive. Gaming bargains to help keep your hobby alive. It's one of the best and friendliest communities on the internet. And if you're one of us mature gamers, find like-minded comment.
And as we move on to the third hour of this week's podcast, we take a look at the financial results of both Electronic Arts and Activision Blizzard, and compare how each one has performed during the last quarter. Now, as we all know, both companies have...
Tired of lengthy gaming podcasts that never get straight to the point? Tune into Gameburst, a new show that delivers the latest news, hard-hitting topical discussions and more in just 30 minutes. Gameburst launches on Sunday, May the 9th, 2010, and will be available at www.gameburst.co.uk.
And we hope you enjoyed that discussion. Stick around for the fourth hour, where we'll be looking at the latest personnel changes at some of the UK's leading developers.
Okay, let's move on to the last game. I think that goes to Zan.
Yeah, which I think was Splinter Cell Conviction.
Yeah.
In our pre-show discussion. Yeah, so... this point I was making earlier about Halo is that with these franchises, it's, and you know, I completely agree with everyone's points that made on Halo, it's so difficult to know where to go next with it. Do you make the same game again, in which case, you know, everyone who's a fan of the series leaps with joy and, great, I've got a new story I can play through and I can do all the moves that I'm familiar with, or do you completely change it and go for something different? Maybe trying to appeal to a new audience. And it feels to me with Splinter Cell Conviction that they kind of gone down the middle. So it's not quite the very, very intense, unforgiving stealth action game that the original Splinter Cells were. And it's also not the really accessible, really sort of mass audience game that they were maybe pitching it at. And certainly for me, again, another series that I've been a big fan of the Splinter Cell series. Some of the things they've taken out, I think, outweigh some of the good things they've done and that they've put in. I've played through the story and I've played through the co-op and done some of the online modes. And actually, for me, the highlight was the co-op. I thought the co-op was excellent, and the co-op sort of struck the perfect balance between being quite stealthy still and requiring you to have a stealthy strategy and tactics, whilst being still fairly accessible to a mainstream audience. The main game itself felt very much to me like what was it called? Was it called The Bourne Supremacy?
The Bourne Conspiracy,
which people may know, I absolutely loved. I thought that was one of the best kind of movie book tie-ins for many years, and it kind of went under the radar, and not many people liked it that much. But I actually thought that was genius, and there's a lot of stuff from that game that they've borrowed in Conviction. So when you play Splinter Conviction, it's more like a Bourne action film than it is the kind of Metal Gear Solid inspired stealth action game that we previously had. And I know that fans of the series have really lamented the fact that a lot of the moves have been taken out, like the split jump.
I know, and
it's quite funny because I thought I'd put Chaos Theory in just to see what the old Splinter Cell was like once I'd play Conviction. And my God, you have to be a contortionist to do half the moves. You have to hold down about five different buttons, and you have to be in pixel perfect alignment with the wall. And so actually looking back, I was thinking, yeah, those moves were great when you did them, but my God, they were fiddly. And I can kind of see why they took them out. But personally, I actually did really enjoy the game. But I think the real reward for me was the co-op.
Also, realistically, Mr. Fisher is getting on in years. He can't be sort of jumping up walls quite so much. And there was a lot less acrobatics, although he did hang off. He's fast when nipping around, clinging onto walls and just like hanging under windows. But I went back
Jack
and
Bauer.
After I finished Conviction, I went back and tried to do the last level of Splinter Cell Double Agent, which I almost finished before I started Conviction, because I knew that if I had to go back to it, I'd feel like I did last night, which was, oh my God, this is slow and punitive and painful. And, oh, you fucked up. Well, hang on, come on, lad, to swear.
Yeah.
No. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And, oh, you messed up, restart. Oh, you messed up, restart, restart, restart. There was none of that restarting in Conviction, which I really relished. Just the fact that if you did mess up, you could just go and there were things you could do to get around it, and you were encouraged to be aggressive, which I far prefer to the whole sneaking around Splinter Cell, which I know is a weird, point of view to take with the Splinter Cell series. But then again, I've acquired over the past few years 3 of the first 4 Splinter Cell games and been really alienated by them. I love them in concept, but in execution, not so fun. So
see,
this was a real step forward for me.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And although I still love the previous ones, and I love Double Agent, and I love the multiplayer, the Spy vs. Mercs, which I think is the thing I really do miss the most. I was looking forward to
that. Yeah, they could have done that.
That being evolved, because it was quite limited in Double Agent. It wasn't the same as you had in Pandora Tomorrow and Chaos Theory, but I was hoping they'd do a lot with that, and they did just took it out completely. But I think this game would have been appreciated better, because it has had a mixed reaction, for sure, had it not been called Splinter Cell. So had it been called Tom Clancy's, Revenge of Sam Fisher or something like that, or, something along those lines.
Kept
or
the even, same story, same character, just changed the name.
Yeah, absolutely. Or maybe called it, Echelon Rising or something like that. Not called it Splinter Cell, but kept maybe the same characters or whatever.
Same as they're taking the Tomb Raider prefix out of the Lara Croft game.
I don't think there would have been the people would have been far more open to the fact that it had changed direction and it could become more of an Uncharted style game.
The funny thing is, I listen to everyone complain about how much it's changed, and I don't actually believe it's changed a great deal. I think you need to. I mean, so if you just jump in and you play on the normal settings and you use your mark and execute as much as possible, then you can pretty much walk through the game fairly easy. But I think if you want that Splinter Cell experience, and that's what something I was after, I put it on realistic. I then kind of set a rule set around my own self and said, look, I'm going to take down guys as silently as possible. I think that, and you can do that. And I think the difference here is the only thing that doesn't happen, if you mess up just one section, the alarm goes off. Now the game doesn't end and you have to restart a section. The game just now goes, oh, now you're in trouble, and you get the hell out there. You jump out the window and you use that to your advantage. I think all that stuff is in there, and I think they've done a fine balance of bringing the old Splinter Cell as well as the new Splinter Cell. But at the same time, I can't imagine... Well, Splinter Cell was losing popularity. It's there's a reason it went away for 2-3 years? 2 years, isn't it?
There's also a reason why the games themselves used to end up extremely cheap on the second-hand market, because they were bought in mass popularity to begin with, and then everybody who wasn't a big fan of Splinter Cell, which is, let's face it, a fairly niche crowd, rejected them and said, actually, I don't really need that.
I just wanted to kind of further on Tony's point, because I'm actually new to the Splinter Cell series. Conviction's my first one, but I've been playing Metal Gear Solid games and Thief games, and I feel like coming from the Metal Gear Solid games, which have almost gone through this already in some way. You know, Metal Gear Solid 2 was incredibly punishing on the player. You know, you did one thing wrong and you were in shit for the rest of that period. And then you got to Metal Gear Solid 3, it allowed you to shoot and move at the same time, and then Metal Gear Solid 4 took that to running and shooting, and it was essentially you could play it stealth or you could play it action. And for some reason, that didn't seem to annoy as much as Splinter Cell Conviction has to the old base. You know, I think the Metal Gear Solid fans were more welcoming of that, and it's maybe I don't know why that is, but in any case, coming to Conviction, I've had no problem with it. Going on to Realistic, I've sometimes, like I think I wrote about it, I've gone in stealth, come out commando, you know, just shooting everyone left, right and centre, but I've not had that much of a problem on the Realistic setting, actually dealing with most people in a stealthy way, if I really put my mind to it.
I think that they haven't done themselves any favours. There's a couple of points, certainly towards the back end of the game, where stealth is, you can't use it. You have to break out the big weapons and you have to push
right.
through it. I mean, I know Dits of the Gamer scene would always talk about, you know, the section where ultimately you're becoming, you know, invincible. You basically every mark and execute and you just, you know, shoot your way through people, and, you know, that's not what he wanted from a Splinter Cell, which is fair enough. But the Splinter Cell series had to change, because, to be honest, I kind of stopped playing them, because I was like, well, you know, games need to be less punishing than this.
Well, just on that point, though, just on the whole thing of that moment where you can, you know, you are invincible, that was surely an artistic thing, wasn't it? It was a story thing. It was to show that he was in this kind of
rage
moment. And I thought it was quite effective.
It was actually quite a powerful moment as well, the actual storyline that led to that. I was actually, he wants to get to that person, so it makes sense.
There was a couple of neat touches in it. I thought the chase sequence was quite a neat idea as well. I know it's been done in other games, but I thought that was really well handled and really well done.
Yeah, and I didn't screw up on it that much, so that basically meant that they had pitched the difficulty just right, so that it was a chase sequence that wasn't, you know, oh, you screwed up, do it again, screwed up, do it again. It reflected the rest of the game of just keep going. You know, it had a lot of forward motion.
That's actually something that I think, because of, you know, a lot of people complained it's not Splinter Cell, and then everyone else is going up and backing it. I think the thing that's been lost here is I actually think the presentation of the Splinter Cell Conviction is fantastic. The way that it blends, I mean, the story's reasonable. It's certainly not a work of art, but it's not the worst I've ever seen, and it's probably not the best in within the franchise. But the way that it connects the scenes, and you don't really ever feel like you've been backed out of the game, and everything makes, you know, perfect sense, because you're being taken as a journey throughout there. I was really impressed with it. Now the stuff on the wall, I can, you know, take it or leave it, but I actually think, you know, the general flow of the game was actually fantastic.
I was actually a big fan of the words on the wall stuff, except when it was used in a dramatic sense. So, I mean, in terms of, you know, as a signpost of what you're meant to do next, I thought it was fantastic, and I really hope other game developers will, you know, spin it in ways that works. You could just imagine it in Uncharted or something, you know, with that sequence where Drake was escaping from the cave and he was muttering to himself. That would have been far more effective if there were little things on the wall, I think. But the dramatic sense, I think, is that I don't want to spoil it, but there's that revelation halfway through, and you see all of Fisher's emotions on the wall. That was just a bit silly. Rage, betrayal, trust. It's like, yeah, okay, I don't need you to tell me what he's feeling. I can work it out, actually.
And the loading screen always kept going, grim.
But
it is kind of grey, actually. It is a bit grim.
but the actual animation of him, you know, going through torment was fantastically done, and the walk into third echelon, maybe that's a spot, I don't know, but, you know, the slow pace and you know, the kind of kickoff line, I thought that was really, really well done, and it's something that's kind of been just overlooked for a lot of people shouting, well, it's not Splinter Cell, which maybe is fair enough.
I think the other interesting thing to bear in mind with the Splinter Cell series, and particularly Ubisoft, is that they've basically almost damaged their own brand, because a lot of the team responsible for the Splinter Cell series are the ones that now do Assassin's Creed, which in many ways is a kind of similar game. It's kind of similar concept. Okay, it's not as stealthy as the original Splinter Cells, but it is effectively another stealth-based action game. And I think a lot of the reasons why Splinter Cell was delayed was because Assassin's Creed, the first one, although not perfect, was a major hit and a bit of a game changer in terms of what people then were going to expect from a future stealth game. And I think that's why they ditched their Hobo Fischer.
Well, did you see that as well? That looked like it was basically just Assassin's Creed with Sam Fisher.
Well, it did, and I'm absolutely convinced that they reused some of the assets from that, because you know the fairground level, which is right at the beginning, which is against me.
Yeah, that stands out a bit. Yeah,
it was. If you saw any of the hobo footage, it was all in that fairground. So I think they reused a lot of the assets from that, but they changed. They certainly changed the approach to the game.
Do you not think that it's not just Assassin's Creed? It's the genre in general has changed since the last Splinter Cell. I mean, you look at like I said, Metal Gear Solid, and then there is Assassin's Creed, Uncharted, Batman Arkham Asylum, which have done different things with stealth and made it, they've almost just brought it in as a kind of mini genre within their own games, especially like, you know, Batman Arkham Asylum, which I don't think many people would instantly describe as a stealth game, but there was a lot of stealth in it.
Yeah, it felt the most similar to Arkham Asylum for me, definitely.
But I mean, for a second, I mean, if I was, you know, the kind of person that absolutely loves Splinter Cell, and I love the way that, you know, it played, and I can maybe come from their point and say, well, where do they go now? Because those games are coming all but non-existent. And where do you go for that genre experience? Because, I mean, gaming is changing. There's no two ways about that. And it seems like, I mean, if you look at the new Ghost Recon game from Ubisoft, I mean, it's all future tech now, and I remember playing Ghost Recon when I had to crawl through a bush and then fire a sniper rifle after 20 minutes of, you know, going through undergrowth, and all of a sudden there's, you know, the new Ghost Recon is you know, pretty much spaceships. And I'm not too sure what's filling that gap for me. It seems like a lot of the genres are just kind of, you know, melded into different types of games now.
There's always FIFA 4 around the corner. Who knows what that will be like? Silence.
Not a fan of the original Thieves.
Right. I don't know. I just, maybe there, as much as you'd like that, Tony, I don't know if there is a huge demand for that type of game anymore. And I'm be honest, I'm not 100. You know, that sad to see it die. I wouldn't cry tears if there wasn't a game as punishing as Metal Gear Solid 2 was again.
I'm just playing devil advocate. I love the fact that the series is changing. I can see points where you know, people are really, you know, growing up with Sam Fisher being one thing, and all of a sudden they're being delivered another. But I think honestly, it comes down to how you play that game. I think you can take the easy route out in many respects, or you can just, you know, play it the old Splinter Cell way and get more enjoyment if that's what you want. And I think that's the ingenious of that title, is that right. It actually plays to both crowds, but you need to go searching out for it. And certainly something like the hunter mode in the online co-op is fantastic, because, you know, the whole idea of that is not to be spotted. Otherwise, they add 10 more enemies onto the, you know, onto the count, and you have to deal with a situation that got a hell of a lot worse. And we've been playing that on the realistic and just desperately trying to get through the entirety of a level and not be spotted once, which we actually finally succeeded last night. So, yeah, that's stuff there.
To satisfy the original Splinter Cell crowd, is there a mode that basically is massively punishing and makes you do everything again if you get seen?
Yes. Is it infiltration? It's the hunter mode where you...
No, sorry, I mean the main game. Like a difficulty that's even higher than realistic. Unrealistic, if you because if that's an oversight, if they didn't, just put something in. I mean, would it have cost them that much to basically effectively break the game and just say, like, have everything freeze every time you get seen and go, Sam, oh, okay, everybody shot you. Right, do it all again. Because obviously you aren't being given your marching orders anymore. You're being effectively just about held in line by people who are trying to sort of help you.
That's a good point. I'd never know about, you know, like, should every game accommodate for every difficulty? I feel like the immediate answer is yes, but I feel it can't be quite as simple as that.
I just, it couldn't have been that difficult, surely, to basically make it so that you can't be spotted in the game at all, to give something to the old Splinter Cell fans, because obviously it's a different engine, and that's the most noteworthy thing about it when you start playing it. The movement is entirely different. So just to give the people who would feel a great loss from the changes,
I don't know,
something
because,
to chew with.
As I said before, I think there's some sections in the game that, you know, really do go against what Splinter Cell has been doing, and there would be no way not to be seen. But this is something we talked about. I showed the way that there should be a difficulty in there that just says old Splinter Cell, and one of the things you'd actually end up using, because you pretty much can go through the entirety of this game using a pistol and mark and executing people, that you end up with all this great gadgetry and you never really get to try it. I mean, in the end, I actually forced myself to use a lot of the gadgets just because I was like, well, I've upgraded everything, I probably should eventually use, you know, the remote camera and do the whistle, and all that stuff was classic Splinter Cell. But it never really, it said, like, you know, you probably should use this here, this would be a great situation. It was always about, well, you know, you can probably just wander here through here, one headshot and you're done.
It never seems appropriate using a wall mine, though, because the whole point is to try and keep as quiet as possible. So, you know, you never think, oh, well, I want to set off a small controlled explosion and kill this guy. Well, why don't I just sneak up on him and kill him? It's quicker and easier.
Sorry, you guys.
I was going to say, yeah, but those are kind of useful when you have the... there's a couple of times where you basically got to defend a position. So, I mean, that's where that sort of weaponry comes in. But I was going to say, the biggest... You know, for me, being a fan of the previous games, the thing that was kind of glaringly missing from a lot of it, even on the co-op actually, was, and I don't think it's something you can change just by tweaking the difficulty or changing the, you know, effectively what you're equipped with. It's the fact that particularly on Chaos Theory, which is kind of the benchmark of the series, is that in every situation there was probably about three or four different ways you could approach that location. So there would be a pipe, or there would be a tunnel, or there would be a window you could go through, or there would be something else. A lot of the time on this game, and on the co-op as well, it's true, until you get near quite near the end, there was only ever one route. So there are later on more options, but certainly for a large chunk of the game, you didn't have any option. You either had to run in, or there was an obvious pipe. There wasn't the kind of freedom to choose what you could do. You could either, basically, you had two choices. You could either run in and run and gun, or you could leap out of a window, pick a few off, jump in, and take the rest out. I mean, those are really the only options you ever had.
I think if you want something like that in a next gen game, then the first half of Metal Gear Solid 4 really does allow for a lot of different ways to approach it. But that game is its own beast and does a lot of strange things in the second half, so that goes with a word of caution, I'd say.
2 hour cutscenes.
Yeah, you've got to like your cutscenes. Okay, I think about hour 15, that'll pretty much do us. So before we go, I would just like to say a big thank you to Zan, to Alex, and to Tony for coming on and talking games with us. So, and also, guys, Alex, Tony, tell us about your show, because it's been a while since we had you on, and I'm sure our listeners would like to know about the Digital Cowboys.
Do you want to do this, Danny?
Nah, you can pimp. You're a better pimp, man.
I'm indeed a good pimp. Digital Cowboys. It's me and Tony, and hopefully a regular special guest on every week. We get to try and get specialists who know about the specific subject we're talking about. And we change it up, and it's actually not dissimilar to Big Red Potion. We try and sort of look deeper, you know, get to the most interesting aspects of it. We try and keep it fun, light, interesting, and occasionally we may delve into something that could be considered pretentious, and we enjoy that. Yes, we do. And yeah, huge community, we love them, and do come along, we will welcome you with open arms.
Yeah, if you just pop over to thedigitalcowboys.com on the website, that basically takes you anywhere and all the information you probably need to know at this point.
Indeed.
Excellent. I was going to say in the links to another show, to Gamer Dog, that they've just had Garnet Lee, so
yeah,
Digital Cowboys, who have you had on recently to beat that?
Well, it depends on you know, because a lot of Americans would be like, who? Dominic Diamond. We love him.
Yeah, I mean,
and I'll say, the Ian Lee interview was extremely good, I thought.
Yes, Ian Lee, yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, well done to the chaps for getting Garnet Lee.
Green with envy.
Yeah, we're definitely green with envy. But I think we got a few surprises up our sleeves in the future.
We
but,
have.
But I mean, and it's. I mean, I think that's almost every podcaster's dream, is to talk to some people that has inspired us, to kind of follow this passion. So yeah, I'd love to talk to Garnet Lee at one point, and who knows in the future. I think we'll probably leave it a few months at this point, but I'm looking forward to listening to that.
.. Okay, excellent. So that's at thedigitalcowboys.com, and thanks again so much for coming on the show, guys.
No worries.
And Dan, how about yourself? You've been busy podcasting too.
Yeah, last week we did the monthly show that I do for the Gamer Scene, and which is the replay show, which is the retrospective show. We basically look back at games that are, sort of 2 or 3 years old now, and I always find that's quite a interesting thing to do, particularly if you have certain memories of how these games were when you played them the first time. It really is fascinating how quickly the industry moves and how quickly the game design evolves. Really, it's so fast. And when you think some of these games have been developed for 5 years. You know, when they started developing these games, the whole landscape was completely different. So it is sometimes amazing. In the previous show, we look back at 2003, I think, or 2000. Because every month we look back at a year in the last decade. So, and I got some very fond memories of 2003. And the other guys will appreciate. We had a little bit of discussion about Project Gotham Racing 2, which I had a very emotional time playing recently when they switched off Xbox Live.
Yeah, I was there. It was good.
With Alex, yeah. And Tony. And it was a fantastic experience. So we talked about that, and we talked about Lego Star Wars The Complete Saga, and I think it's fair to say that it hasn't aged particularly well.
Right.
And I think you said, Sinan, on Twitter the other day that if you never have to play another Lego game, that will be too soon. I mean, I'm kind of the opposite. I love them all, and I'm really looking forward to Harry Potter.
Yeah.
I think actually going back to those Star Wars games, they are really quite basic now when you play them, and it just shows how much has changed in 3 years.
Yeah, because everyone says the Lego games are all just the same, thing with a new skin over the top, so that's obviously not the case.
Definitely not.
Does anyone know if Lego Indiana Jones 2 was any good?
If it's anything like Lego Indiana Jones 1.
No.
I thought you said it had been getting better.
I just can't stand those games. I don't know. I loved Lego as a kid, but my God, I played Lego Star Wars, and it's just after playing that a second time and then coming to Lego Indiana Jones, oh my God, those games are dull. But
it's just the same thing. Wander into a new room, kick over the trash cans, put a button together with the bits that fall out of the trash cans, press the button, a door opens. Move on.
Yeah, that's if people like that, that's fine. Good for them.
they're a lot more nuanced now. I think certainly Lego Batman was, although I didn't like everything about it, there's a lot more to them now. The puzzles are much more sophisticated. And because you've got so many different characters and so many different abilities, in the Star Wars games, it was like you said, you kick a bucket over, you put the bricks together, that solves one puzzle, or you choose a light or dark character and it opens something up. But in the more recent games, they've been a lot more complex as to how you actually solve the puzzle. You may have to use 4 different characters, for example, and sometimes you have to solve one puzzle to then reveal another. So they have got far more clever in their puzzle design, and from what I hear about Lego Harry Potter, they've kind of changed the direction slightly, because there's no combat in it, there's no destruction, which will be interesting.
Are there gaps that you can fall into and lose all of your points?
Well, that's the thing they did wrong with Batman. I mean, they had a hub world where you could constantly fall off, which
that's the bit that always drove me crazy, because I love the fact that it's like there's no permanent death, so you can play it with your kids. But if you want to get, because you like collecting stuff, all of the little Lego minifigs in Star Wars so you can change your characters around, and your partner or your kid or whatever just keep falling off a ledge, and like all of your points are being sucked away, you just like through gritted teeth just say, could you just stop doing that?
Do you want a game tip here?
Yes.
I can get right, okay. When you play those games, don't bother collecting the studs until you've got the red bricks, because later on you can get 3 red bricks, which effectively give you a times 28 multiplier. So when you, if you want to go back through and then do the studs then, you'll actually max out the studs within about 30 seconds of starting each level.
Cool.
Big red potion tip.
I'll look for the red bricks.
Yeah, so the idea of those games is to ignore the studs. Forget about studs are irrelevant, really. Just play through the game regularly and try and find the red bricks. And then once you've got the red bricks, turn all those on and go through again. And your multipliers and your bonuses are so great. Like, you can have it so that every character that dies, they spit out studs. So with the times 28 multiplier, you've only got to, like, kill three characters and you've maxed out the stud meter.
You're a genius. Thank you.
There you go.
The one question, I'll do that.
The one question I have, Zan, is the controls. Are they any better in Lego Batman?
No, Lego Batman, if anything, was worse.
Oh, good. Right. Then I'm not going to play that game.
And it still has really bad screen tearing. So, bizarre as it sounds, sometimes you're better off playing those games on the Wii.
Well, actually, all I will say on that fact is that my nephew has been playing Lego Star Wars on the DS. Just the first one for, I think, about the last 4 years since it came out. And he's still only at 44% complete. And every time I go around there, he's playing the same levels over and over again. But he loves it. So they obviously have some sort of charm.
Fair enough. And I've completely forgot. We're going to be on your show, Tony, Alex. Zan, yes, and I and Joe in very shortly. Should I keep that quiet, or do you want to?
No, say it. Yeah.
Okay. So what are we going to talk about?
Well, we are going to talk about packaging complexity. At least if I can get my head round it by Tuesday. If I can't, we'll improvise something else. But basically, it's how to get like massively complex games like Mass Effect into easy to digest packages like Mass Effect 2.
Wow. Okay, we better brush up on that.
Yes.
I don't want to be the only person having to study up on it. It brings something to the table, definitely.
Yeah, we'll try. We didn't do very well last time. Jan, you'll be back next week as well on this show, won't you?
Yes, sure.
Joining Eddie and Joe, who has been he's going to be recovering today, Sunday, from a bachelor party he organised. So, Joe, if you're listening, I hope you feel better. Keep the volume low. We'll talk to you next week. Apart from that, we've got a show next week. We've got a show in 2 weeks' time with another special guest, so look for that. And otherwise, enjoy the rest of the week. We'll talk to you in 7 days.